All right, tonight we're going to move into lesson number 7, I guess it is. We're on the back half of our series. And there you go, have that Bible. And last week, if you remember, we looked at some of the trouble that Abraham's descendants got into. Abraham's descendants were the Jewish people, and they went down into Egypt. And we saw that Egypt gave them a very hard time. They ended up becoming slaves. And God said, that's no way to treat my people. And so he sent along some plagues. Remember what the plagues were? The terrible national disasters that hit the country. And they had all kinds of these difficulties that they faced that pretty much wiped out the land of Egypt. The last plague had something to do with killing a lamb. And do you remember how we talked about the lamb's blood was taken in a bowl and they went over and they painted some of it along the doorpost of the house, and God came through that night, and whoever was inside the house, whoever was had the door closed and they stayed inside, when God came over, he said that he would pass by or pass over that house. And the people inside were protected by the blood of the lamb. So in other words, the lamb gave its life for the protection of the people inside. And God said that he would pass over that house, and none of those people in there, none of the firstborn, would die. And we also saw that everybody who did not do that, all the firstborn males in their families, whether they were animals or human beings, they died that night, including Pharaoh. Pharaoh had a son, and his firstborn son was the one to die. And at that point, we saw that Pharaoh called Moses, and he said, you people, get out of here. I'm sick and tired of you being around here. Pack your stuff and shove off. Go. Get out of here. And literally almost threw them out of the country. And on the way out, they said to the Egyptians, hey, can I take this? Can I take that? Can I have your coat? How about your gold ring and your fancy ornaments? And they said, here, take them, take them. Just get out of here. That was our story last week. There was one thing I think that I failed to tell you is that the promised one, the one that God said would come and destroy evil, well, that Passover lamb is very similar. What happened to that Passover lamb is very similar to what is going to happen to him when he shows up. Okay? The lamb gave his life. The lamb set the people free. Basically, by his death, they were allowed to leave Egypt. And there are many similarities between what the Jewish people celebrate as a Passover festival or a ceremony. It's an annual event now held by Jewish people. It's called Passover. And it happens around Easter time in the spring. And so I failed to mention that last week, but I'll mention that now. So this evening we're going to start in the second book again. This is the book of Exodus, and it's chapter 19. This is on page 55, if you have a red Bible like I do, 55. And this will be our last lesson in this book. You might think, well, how are we going to get through most of the book? We've already covered, this will be lesson number 7, and we've only covered this much material. Well, after tonight, we get into our Lear jets, and we move very quickly. So we're going to, and don't think you're going to miss, we're going to miss some of the material here anyway, but the next 2 weeks are really going to be flying. So anyway, we're in chapter 19. This will be the last time that we're in the book of Exodus. At this point in the story, Moses is still the leader of the Jewish people. And remember now, the Jewish people went into Egypt and they were internationals living in the land of Egypt. They were there for 400 years. So all of the generations of children that were born in Egypt became essentially bicultural people. And then when they left Egypt, they once again became international. So now we have a whole nation of Jewish people who are leaving Egypt, and now they have left Egypt, and now the whole country, they're raised in one country, they're kind of thrown out of the country, and now they become a whole nation of wandering international people, international Jewish people. So they have been traveling now for 3 months, and it's been kind of a rough journey along the way. But anyway, we'll pick it up in chapter 19, and let's begin reading in verse 1. And it says, "In the third month after the Israelites left Egypt, on that very day they came to the desert of Sinai." Now, this is in the land of Egypt, modern Egypt today. If you know where the Sinai Peninsula is, it's that little triangular-shaped piece of land between Egypt and between Israel. That's the Sinai Peninsula, and that is where they are at this time. So they came to the desert of Sinai. Verse 2, after they set out from Rephidim, and as far as we can tell, Rephidim was an oasis, you know, where the palm trees go and the spring comes up. And it's the only green thing in the whole desert. Little oasis where the palm trees are. And it's a nice place to water your camels and water your kids and all that kind of thing. So they came out from Rephidim, and they entered the desert of Sinai. And Israel, that's the nation of Israel, camped there in the desert in front of the mountain. Now this mountain is a special mountain. We'll find out in a few minutes. Verse 3, then Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain and said, "This is what you are to say to the house of Jacob, and what you are to tell the people of Israel." God is meeting Moses on the top of this mountain. So that God has been telling Moses where to go. They got to the desert. There's a mountain there. Moses goes up into the mountain, and God speaks to Moses when Moses is in the mountain. So in verse 4, God tells Moses what he should say to the people of Israel. And this is it. He says, "You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt." That would be the plagues. "And how I caught you on eagles," I'm sorry, "how I carried you on eagles' wings and brought you to myself." So they've made pretty good time getting to the mountain. Verse 5, "Now, if you will obey me fully and keep my covenant," covenant means agreement, "then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words you are to speak to the Israelites." So see, he's offering them a deal. He says, if you obey me, if you do everything that I ask you to do, then out of all of the nations that I could choose, out of all of the countries that I could work with, I will choose you to have special responsibilities. That's what he's saying. And this is the proposition, this is the deal, this is the offer that he is giving to Moses to give to the people, the Jewish people. So, in verse 7, "So Moses went back and summoned the elders of the people and set before them all the words the Lord had commanded him to speak." So he relays the message. And in verse 8, notice what the people say. The people all responded together. Now notice this very carefully. "We will do everything the Lord has said." You see that? Now, you might want to look at this word, everything. "We will do everything the Lord has said." So, Moses brought their answer back to the Lord. Now, this is a very interesting response from these people. Do you know why? One of the parts that we were not able to cover, because this is only 12 lessons long, and I'll fill you in a little bit here. Back in chapter 16, they have been walking through this desert, leaving Egypt, wandering into this wilderness. They've been walking for 3 months. And they estimate that the crowd, the number of people that left Egypt, was at least 1 million people. Now, 1 million people eat a lot of food, and they drink a lot of water. If you had 1 million people that stopped in at 20 7-Elevens, or some quick stop or someplace like that, well, they'd clean the whole place out and there wouldn't be enough food in there to feed all of them. So finding food and finding water for 1 million people is a pretty big job. They eat and they drink a lot. And what happened was, in chapter 16 of this book, the book of Exodus, they ran out of water. Now remember, this is the God that had done all of these marvelous, miraculous plagues. And in chapter 16, when they ran out of water, they didn't believe that God could provide the water for them. And so you know what they did? They got very rude and nasty, and they complained, and they fussed, and they act just like little kids. See? And then in chapter 17, a little bit further on their journey, they ran out of food. And instead of trusting in God and waiting for God to do something, they did the same thing. They fussed, they complained, they were all ready to go back to Egypt. They said, enough is enough, let's go back to Egypt. At least we had food back there. And they just complained and they acted just like little kids again. And so now look at what they're saying. In chapter 19, they're saying, we will do everything the Lord has said. Now, is it right to complain about our problems to God? Is it really right to do that? When He can do anything He wants, when He can provide for our needs, is it right to complain? I don't think it is. He already knows what's going on. Remember, we said that God knows everything ahead of time. We've already seen Him predict the future, so He knows exactly when we run into a problem, He knows exactly what the solution is to get us out of our problem. And these people are promising something that they really cannot deliver on. Can they guarantee that everything that they do, or whatever God says, they can do that? Can they guarantee that? Kate, what do you think? Let me ask this question. Now, here these people are promising to do everything that God has said, okay? They've already kind of blown it in chapter 16 and chapter 17. Oh, by the way, God did give them water in chapter 16, and God did give them food in chapter 17. So God is taking care of His people. God is not being unfaithful. Sure, they ran out of food, but they didn't starve to death. Nobody died. They got their food, and they kept on, because now they're here, the 3 months into the journey, and they're at the mountain, and everybody has been taken care of. So they've got all their needs. God has been faithful to them. And so these people now are saying, we will do everything. Now think about this for just a minute. God knows exactly what these people are like. These people have shown so far that when they didn't get what they wanted, when they wanted it, they complained. He knows that these people are not patient. He knows that these people really don't trust Him yet. They're not too sure about this God. And now He says He's going to make a deal with these people. And if you look back in verse 5, He says, now if you will obey Me fully and keep My covenant. See, He is looking for perfect obedience. And the way we know that is the way the people responded. In verse 8, the people say, we will do everything. So see, it's very clear. God is looking for perfect, complete obedience. Now, here is a question. If God knows what these people are really like, and He knows these people are not perfect, these people will never be perfect, these people are going to sin. They're going to make mistakes. They're going to be stubborn sometimes. Why would a God who is perfect make a deal like this with people who are not perfect when the arrangement is you have to obey Me perfectly and completely? Why is He doing that? Why is He offering them that kind of a deal when He already knows that they can't keep it? They can't keep the terms of this agreement. Does it sound like God is being unfair? Is He trying to trick them into doing something they can't do? What do you think? Anybody have any ideas? Why would a perfect God ask for perfect obedience from imperfect people when He already knows ahead of time that they cannot keep the agreement? Does that sound strange to you? Why would God do something like that? Any ideas? Okay. Yeah, what's that? Somebody else got? What? What's that? Okay, a couple good answers there. Okay, yeah, we're on the right track here. God is a perfect God, and these people are not perfect people, yet they're saying they will obey God in everything. So they're really saying, hey, we can do whatever God says. So essentially, these people are full of pride, and they're full of confidence, right? Hey, we'll do everything that God says. No problem. Piece of cake, as we say here in America. We'll get the job done. And what if we don't do it the first time, well, we'll do it the second time. We'll just keep on going. And so what God is trying to show them, like several people have suggested now, is that God needs to let them know that they are not as good as they think they are. And he has to make an agreement with them to show them that they cannot keep the agreement. Okay? And what that means is if they think they're perfect and they think they can keep all these commands that God is going to give them, he needs to show them very clearly how wrong they are. And if they see that they can't live up to the arrangement that God makes for them, maybe, just maybe, they'll begin to realize that and they'll start looking for who? The promised one, right? Maybe they'll say, hey, you know, God gave us these laws and we can't keep up with these laws, and man alive, this is really too hard for us to do. Man, there's got to be some way out of this. And maybe they would begin to start looking for the promised one that God said he would send a very long time ago. He's going to be coming. So, look in verse 9. So the Lord said to Moses, I am going to come to you in a thick cloud, so that the people will hear me speaking with you and will always put their trust in you. See? At the very heart of things, God wants people to trust him, to believe him. Then Moses told the Lord what the people had said. Verse 10. And the Lord said to Moses, go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow. Have them wash their clothes and be ready by the third day, because on that day the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. Put limits for the people around the mountain and tell them, be careful that you do not go up on the mountain or touch the foot of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. He shall surely be stoned or shot with arrows. Not a hand is to be laid on him. Whether man or animal, he shall not be permitted to live. Only when the ram's horn sounds a long blast may they go up to the mountain. Now, look at what's going on. God says when he comes down to the mountain from the sky in this big, thick cloud, he says nobody goes up on the mountain. And look at all the things they have to do. They have to consecrate themselves. That means to make themselves ready, get themselves prepared. They have to wash their clothes. They have to put a fence, some sort of a marker, all the way around the mountain. Nobody's allowed to touch the mountain. Nobody's allowed to put a foot on the mountain, or they'll have to be killed. So see, what God is saying here is that he is perfect. He is sinless. He doesn't do anything wrong. He's perfect. He's holy. He's special. And he's saying, by all of these things that the human people have to do, you people are not perfect. You're not sinless. You people have made mistakes. You people have complained. And he's showing that there is a difference between the nature of God and the nature of human beings. So when he comes down on the earth, everybody else has to stay away from this mountain, because he is making the mountain special by his presence there. So down in verse 16, he says, on the morning of the third day, there was thunder and lightning, and with a thick cloud over the mountain and a very long trumpet blast, everyone in the camp trembled. They were shaking. They were starting to get nerves, because this is the day that God is going to come down from the sky. Then Moses led the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. They didn't go up. They didn't go beyond the limit, but they stood right at the edge. let me see, where am I? There, verse 18, Mount Sinai was covered with smoke because the Lord descended on it in fire. The smoke billowed up, rose up from it like smoke from a furnace, and the whole mountain trembled violently. And the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder. And then Moses spoke, and the voice of God answered him. So now we see God coming down from heaven, from the skies, in this big, thick cloud. And the cloud kind of covers the top of the mountain. And the whole mountain is shaking and vibrating back and forth. And the people feel the ground underneath them, and it's shaking like that. And everybody's getting really scared. And then Moses is allowed to go up to the mountain, and God begins to speak to Moses. And this is, in chapter 20, we are going to see some of the rules that God is going to give to his people. Now remember, the people said back in verse 8, we will do everything that God has said. And so now in chapter 20, we're going to find out exactly the kind of rules that God wants his people to keep. Okay? So let's look at chapter 20. Verse 1, and God spoke all these words. So here we go. Now let's watch this. Now, you may have heard these rules before. They're called the Ten Commandments. And this is where we are tonight. Hollywood made a movie called The Ten Commandments, I think, didn't they, one time? Yeah. So anyway, in chapter 20, let's look at verse 1. God spoke all these words. Now here's the first commandment. In verse 2 it says, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. There's the first command, the first rule. You shall have no other gods before me. Verse 4 says, you shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or in the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of their fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. So what he's saying is God is special, he's supreme, and if you're going to be my people, you should not worship anything else, because he is the only person who is rightfully to be worshipped. He's God. He's the one who made the world. He's the one who made Adam and Eve. He's the one who said, if you disobey me, you will die. He's the one who said the promised one is going to come and he's going to take care of evil in the world. He's the one who made all the cultures. He's the one who made all the languages. He's the God, really, of all people, but he's looking for one group of people who will take his message to all the peoples of the earth. And this is the one and the same God. And he's concerned for all peoples, and that's why he says that he needs his people to be obedient. And if they're not going to be obedient, then the children and the grandchildren will suffer from their sin. But if they are obedient, he said, those generations of faithful people will have God's blessing. So in verse 7 now, we get into another commandment, and it says, you shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God. For the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. You hear a lot of people, especially in the United States, take God's name in vain, as we say. In other words, they use it in a careless or a flippant kind of way, and they'll say the name of God or something like that, or they'll curse with God's name and that sort of thing. And that's the kind of thing that God says, do not have that habit in your life. This is really not a good thing. In other words, speak carefully when you use God's name. In verse 8, it says, remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. The word Sabbath means rest. Okay, so it's a day of rest. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son, nor daughter, nor your manservant, nor your maidservant, nor your animals, nor the alien That would be an international who lives in your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. So in other words, God worked on 6 days, he stopped working on the seventh day, and he says, if we are made in God's image and we're similar to God, then we likewise should work no more than 6 days and take a day for rest, take a day for some time off. Okay? So in verse 12, he says, honor your father and your mother, so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. Remember, they left Egypt to go back to the land that he promised Abraham and his descendants. And so this is another indication that they are going to get back to the land that they're supposed to live in. Now, it's interesting. A lot of people, when you begin to ask them, hey, do you worship only God? Oh, yes, I worship only God. Do you ever, misuse the name of God? Oh, no, I never misuse the name of God. And you go down and you ask people, have they kept this command? And a lot of people think, oh, yeah, I'm a pretty good person. I do this, and I don't do those things. I don't do the bad things. I only do the good things. Well, in verse 12, I wonder, look at what it says, honor your father and your mother so that you may live long in the land. I wonder how many kids have perfectly kept this command. What kid always said, yes, mommy, yes, daddy, and ran off and did exactly what they said all the time? Now, I'll be perfectly honest with you. I didn't keep this one either. It would be, some people might think, well, yes, I've never made any idols or anything like that, or I never worshipped anything else but God, or I never misused God's name. But even when you're a kid, see, even the kids are not let off the hook, so to speak. They have to keep honoring their father and their mother. As soon as they disrespect their mother and their father one time, they've broken the rule. See? And remember, they said, we will do everything that the Lord has said. So this means even the children had to honor their mother and their father every day, every month, every year, the whole time while they're growing up. And I bet you the kids didn't know what the parents were getting their kids into when they agreed to this deal with God. And see, I think if everybody were honest here, we could probably say, yeah, I didn't honor my mom and dad either, all the time, every day, every week, every month, every year. You know, one point or one time of not honoring your parents, and boom, you're guilty. See? So I'm out, I'm guilty. I couldn't keep that one either. Well, those are the first five commandments. We're going to get into the second five. It's interesting to note, though, before we go into the second five, that the first five commandments about God, he is to worship God alone, make no images, don't misuse his name, remember the Sabbath day, and then honor your mother and father. Those are the first five commands. And it's interesting that those commands have to do with vertical, what we would call vertical relationships, people who are over us. And the first four have to do with God and human beings. And then the last one, the fifth commandment, has to do with parents and children. So they would be dealing with what we would call vertical relationships. The last five commands have to do with what we would call horizontal relationships. How do human beings get along with their peers or their friends or their neighbors? That would be horizontal relationships. So let's see what kind of commands God says that his people should act towards each other. In verse 13, this is commandment number 6, it says, you shall not murder. And you might think, well, yeah, that's a pretty obvious thing. We shouldn't go around killing each other. And a lot of people may think, well, I've never killed anybody. I haven't broken this commandment, right? But you know, in another place in the Bible, it talks about even if you have felt anger or hatred towards anybody else, in a sense, you have committed murder in your mind.
Ooh, I'd like to get that person back. I'd like to say one thing to them. Ooh, just give me a chance.
And God's word says, ooh, you just killed that person in your mind. See? So we may not actually take the gun or take the knife or take the big baseball bat and go bonk and actually kill them and then they die. But even if we get angry towards somebody, ooh, I just can't stand it anymore. God says, oop, you're guilty. You're murdering him or her in your mind, and that's not what I want you to do. So in verse 14, he says, you shall not commit adultery. And how many people have wondered if they're married? Oh, I wonder what it would be like to be with someone else. You know, I wonder what it would be like if I could just leave this bum and go off and, you know, marry somebody else and all these things, see? And, well, it can go both ways. You know, the guys have a different approach to it, but anyway. So, but just, you know, you may not have to go out and literally commit adultery. You can do it in your mind, you know, by fantasy or something else. You know, you can think about it and God says, hey, you're committing adultery in your mind. And see, people might say, well, I never went out and cheated on my wife. But no, but they may have thought about it a whole lot. And if they have thought about it, God says, oh, well, you see, you're just as guilty because you're thinking the same thing. And usually if you think about something too long, you end up practicing and you end up doing it. So a lot of people who haven't actually committed adultery may sure have thought about it a lot. And they may be guilty that way. In verse 15, it says, you shall not steal. Oh, boy. Anybody guilty of this one? I can remember the first time I stole something from a store. And boy, I'll tell you, for about 30 seconds, I thought, ha-ha, they didn't catch me. And it was just some little rinky-dink thing. I just wanted to see if I could get out of the store with it. I wasn't interested in really stealing it because I wanted it. I just wanted to see if I could get past the store clerk, you know. I walked down about 30 seconds, I felt real good, but then I felt real bad because I knew I had done something wrong, you know. And then I thought, well, I better go take it back inside. And then I thought, oh, no, this is going to be terrible. Then they'll know I stole something. So I don't remember what I did with it, but I just remember feeling real bad. And a lot of people don't have to steal. They could steal in their minds. They might say, oh, boy, I would just like to. Verse 16. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. How many times have you seen a kid who will do something wrong, and you know what they'll do? What happened? He did it. Right? Or, oh, she did it. You know, and usually blame my brother or sister because we don't get along with them, you know, most of the time. And, you know, kids are notorious for this. And so, you know, these poor kids, man, try to live up to these rules. I mean, it's tough. You can begin to see, you know, when the boss comes over and the paperwork isn't done or the job isn't finished and he comes up and says, hey, what's going on here? And the temptation is there to blame somebody else, or sometimes we'll blame a situation. We may not point to so-and-so and say, well, they didn't do this, so I couldn't do that. Many times we'll just say, well, you know, the time got away from me or something like that. We usually end up making these excuses. And so we're giving false testimony. We're not telling the truth. God says, if you're going to be my people, you've got to tell the truth 100% of the time, every day, without fail, every opportunity you have. And then verse 17, the last commandment, it says, you shall not covet. Now, that's really the command, and he gives us a list of things that we should not covet after. We should not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his manservant or maidservant, his ox or his donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. How many times do you see a nice, real slick sports car driving down the road and you think, oh, I'd love to have a car like that, right? Coveting, wanting what it does not belong to you.
Envy.
Envy, okay, yeah, that might be another word for it. So what that really says is do not be unhappy with what you have. That's the positive end of the command. Anytime we're unhappy about what we have, or our state of affairs, or our situation that we're in right now, God says, oh, you blew it. You blew it. You're coveting a better situation, or a better car, or a better job or more money or whatever it might be, anytime we're unhappy or dissatisfied, we're really coveting by saying, I want it to be different. See? Now, if you stop and think about all of these things, all these Ten Commands, these people had agreed to keep these laws perfectly and completely every day, every minute, every month of every year. Do you think that's a good deal or not? Is this an easy job to do or is this a hard job? What do you think? Okay, yeah, I think it's hard too. I mean, you know, you stop and think. You have to live up to these rules perfectly every time. No mistakes. And, yeah, I think it looks awful if you stop and think about it. Well, see, this is what God wanted to show them. Here these people are filled with pride, self-assurance, self-confidence. They think, oh, yeah, whatever, God, you just lay it on us and we'll do it. Just like that. No problem. Well, see, this is what we call the center of God's law. Okay? These are God's laws. This is what he wants his people to do. God's law acts like two different things. God's law, first of all, acts like a mirror. Okay? When you look in the mirror in the morning, when you get up and it's 6 o'clock in the morning and you have to go to school, and you look in the mirror and you go, oh, gross. Look at, oh, I need a shower. I have to clean my hair. And so, but what do you do after that? After you look in the mirror and you see yourself and you say, oh, my goodness, I've got some work to do, right? And you get in the shower and you scrub. Well, you don't take the mirror off the wall and try to scrub your hair, do you? Or wash your face with the mirror? No. The mirror doesn't have that purpose. The mirror is only to show you the way you really are, at least on the outside. Okay? Well, God's law was meant to be like a mirror, except that it was supposed to show us what we're like on the inside. How we think, how we feel, how we act, how we treat God, how we treat our neighbor, how our attitudes are. See? And I think if you realize that if you had agreed to keep this law, you would be very frustrated because you'd find out you couldn't keep it. It's too hard to be a perfect little kid, to always love your neighbor, to always be satisfied in every situation. I mean, that's hard to do. And so God's law is like a mirror. It shows us how we really are like, or what we're really like on the inside. The second thing that God's law is like, it is like a chain. You know what a chain is? It's like a rope made out of metal, and it has these little links, and they lock together. Okay? What happens? How many links do you have to break before you break the whole chain? Only one. If you're holding on to a chain, and somebody's holding on to the top, and you're holding on to the bottom, and that's your lifeline, you only have to break one link and you're gone. See? So what God's law is saying is you have to obey every single command perfectly. And the minute you break only one command on one day in 1 minute, you are guilty of breaking the whole law. Because it all works together like a chain. And see, God says, if you're going to make me happy, if you're going to please me, I'm a perfect God, God says, then you have to obey my laws perfectly. And that, I think, if you're honest, I think you're beginning to see, hey, this is really hard. This is really a hard job that God has asked them to do. So God's law is like a mirror. It's not meant, God's law is not meant for us to try to keep it to be perfect. It's meant to show us how perfect he is and how imperfect, how not so perfect we really are. And that's what he wants them to see. And he says, man, if they can just see that they're not as confident, they're not as perfect as they think they are, then maybe they'll begin to see that I'm going to take care of the problem of evil. I'm going to take care of their bad attitudes. I'm going to take care of sin in the world because they can't do it themselves. They can't even do what I ask them to do. See? So in verse 18, it says, when the people saw the thunder and the lightning and heard the trumpet and saw the mountain and smoke, they trembled with fear. And they stayed away at a distance and said to Moses, speak to us yourself and we will listen. But do not have God speak to us or we will die. These people are very scared. They see the noise, the light, the smoke. They feel the trembling going on. The earth is shaking beneath their feet. God is coming down on the mountain. And they hear God giving out these commands. And they said, enough, please, we have to go hide. This is too scary for us. We're all going to die. And they began to realize how difficult it must be to be pleasing to God. And so in verse 20, Moses said to the people, do not be afraid. God has come to test you so that the fear of God will keep, so that the fear of God will be with you to keep you from sinning. Well, if you're a child and your dad has a big paddle and he says, you do that one more time and I'm going to paddle you. There's a certain amount of fear that can actually work to be beneficial for that child so that child will not be disobedient again. And that's really what Moses is saying here. God wants to help you realize how big he is, how strong he is, how powerful he is, so that with a good, healthy dose of respect and some fear, they realize that their lives could be in jeopardy if they disobey, if they realize that, they will be obedient. And in verse 21, so the people remained at a distance while Moses approached the thick darkness where God was. See, Moses knew God. He could talk to God. And he knew he had permission that he could go up to the mountain and speak with God. None of the other people had that. They were too afraid, too scared. And so they were not allowed on the mountain. But Moses was. Moses really knew. God was like that. But he knew that he was not there to kill the people or destroy the people. He was there to communicate. And we always see that God is communicating with people. All through the Bible, you see God speaking, God showing things, God trying to communicate to human beings who he is like, what he is like, and what he wants. And so this is the end of our lesson tonight. We see that God is going to give them this law, and we see that they're beginning, even at the very early part, that they're a little scared of God. They're not too sure about this God. They've already made this agreement. They said, whatever he says, we'll do. And now, after looking at these rules, it's like, man, how in the world are they ever going to keep these rules? And so God shows them how awesome he is, how strong, how powerful he is. And they say, oh my goodness, we better do whatever he says. Look how big he is. Look how strong he is. He can make the earth shake right under our feet. Next week, we're going to look at Israel once they get back into the land. We're going to find out that God gave them something very special to do that was to be a very special blessing for all the nations of the whole earth. Okay? Just because God has chosen Israel to be his people, that doesn't mean that all the other countries are left out of the program. That's not the case at all. So next week we're going to find out how those countries, how those different cultures fit into the plan of God bringing the promised one the way he said he would do it. So I'm done the lesson. Does anybody have any questions?